Tom Benton was a small man with the vivacity and the pugnaciousness of a Bantam rooster. He made great use of that wonderful mustache of his. Very sparkling eyes. Never saw him at a loss for a word. He had a great persona of the hard-drinking, tough guy who happened to be an artist, you know. His pride was to be able to drink with anybody and fight with anybody and f*** with anybody and so forth. Real He-Man.
There are many kinds of museums, from MoMA to Madame Tussauds, from Orange County to Red Square and everywhere in between. But museum visitors only see a glimpse of the full picture. On this show, we open the crates, tell the stories, meet the people, and reveal the inner workings. Unseen, unheard, until now. From Philbrook Museum of Art and Public Radio Tulsa, I'm your host, Jeff Martin, and this is Museum Confidential.
The follies. Will she yell or stay silent? Go without me or sulk in the corner? Will she be in the bed when the hat and the grass and the parasol have finally found their way? To green? Do I care? To blue? Yes.
In 1985, composer Stephen Sondheim won the Pulitzer Prize for his musical Sunday in the Park with George. Rather than a novel, a moment in history, or other more common source material for musicals, Sondheim and his collaborator James Lapine based this piece on a painting by French pointillist painter Georges Seurat called A Sunday Afternoon on the Island of La Grande Jatée. This is just one example of writers using paintings and other visual art as inspiration to create an entirely new work. That's exactly what award-winning writer Donna Bayer Stein did when she decided to write a new collection of short stories based on works by iconic American artist Thomas Hart Benton. The issues Benton dealt with throughout the Great Depression and after still resonate today. We recently sat down with Stein to talk about her stories, how she landed on Thomas Hart Benton, and the one piece that inspired the whole project. Why did you want to write this book and take on this project? Did it start with one piece that then...
It did.
Yeah, tell me about that.
I own a lithograph of Benton's that I've had hanging on my office wall for a couple decades now. It was given to my father a long time ago. We were all from Kansas City originally, and my father spent most of his life in Kansas City, which was Benton's home. And Weill Gallaher ran a printing company, a lithograph company, and gave an early edition print to my dad. And my parents handed it on to me. And one, I had written a collection of short stories called Sympathetic People. All of those short stories were contemporary, and while they weren't completely autobiographical, they had seeds from incidents in my own life or from the lives of people I knew. And I wanted to get away from that. So I was sitting in my office one day looking at this lithograph on the wall and thinking, okay, let's write a story about that. And the lithograph that I own is called Spring Tryout, if you know it. It's two boys riding bareback on a horse in a field, and one of the boys has just fallen off the back of the horse. And there's a little gray farmhouse in the distance in the lithograph. And so I started literally just describing what I saw, writing a paragraph or two about what I saw in the lithograph. And then I started thinking, well, I've got these two boys, and I knew that I wanted my main characters to be adults. And so I'm looking at two things. One, the farmhouse in the distance. And two, there were some freshly cut logs in the lithographs. I think, okay, an adult has to have been nearby to cut those logs, and somebody has to be taking care of the animals and on the farm and living in that farmhouse. So I imagined a woman dreaming behind the little window in the farmhouse, and that ended up being the boy's mother. And then I went on from there and imagined some other characters. So that first story was published in Virginia Quarterly Review, which is a literary journal, and I had such fun with it, I decided to do it again. And I own a book called The Lithographs of Thomas Hart Benton that was compiled by Creekmore Fath, who was a lawyer who collected Benton's artwork. And this book, I think it was published in 69, although I'm not positive about that. And Fath had realized that he was collecting this, but he didn't have a lot of details about the artwork that he owned. So he started a correspondence with Thomas Hart Benton. And through the years, Benton gave titles to some of the pieces that were untitled. And I think it's 80. I'm just looking at the book here, how many lithographs are in it. I think it's 80 plus. And they go from 1929 to 1967. And so the book includes some handwritten notes from Thomas Hart Benton, some titles, again, on pieces that he hadn't titled before, and most of them have the date and the place where Benton had originally created the drawing. And one of the interesting things, this past last summer, I was in Kansas City for a high school reunion, and one of my classmates took me to Thomas Hart Benton Home and Museum, which is a beautiful stone house, and he had a separate freestanding garage that was his painting studio with like a cathedral ceiling and wonderful light, and it's left exactly the way he left it. He actually died while he was painting. And so I learned that during the summer, he lived in the house with his wife, Rita, and two children. And during the summer, he would take long walkabouts in Missouri and Arkansas and draw the people that he came upon. So most of these lithographs are, many of them, are of people that he saw on his walks. And also in the Fath book, there are some drawings that he did for the characters in the movie Grapes of Wrath. He drew the illustration for the original edition of Grapes of Wrath by John Steinbeck, and he also, his art is also on the movie poster. So those are in the Creekmore Fath book as well.
So when you're taking on a project like this, of course, that first piece was something that was just kind of in your mind. It was around your life for a long time. It was ingrained in you in a certain kind of way. But, you know, the other pieces, you know, you kind of found later. But I wonder, your challenge as a writer, obviously, is you have these lithographs, these images as kind of a jumping off point, right? But if someone were to pick up the story and read it without having seen that piece or having any context, the story needs to work as a standalone as well, right? So how do you kind of make sure that you don't end up using the visual too much and finding that balance?
Yes. Not using it too much and not using it enough, right? And there's also a balance, and one of my own challenges was, well, let me go back for a second. Any time that we're writing about people who were real, whether they're contemporaneous in our lives and our family or friends, or whether they're people that Benton saw, even though they're not identified in Benton's lithographs, they still were real people. So I took a fictional, I've took the liberty of making up stories about these people.
Right.
And the book is presented as fiction, obviously. It's not, these aren't biographical portraits of the people in his artwork.
Thomas Hart Benton, of course, is kind of this icon, this legend. But at the same time, you know, he was very much as part of the school of regionalism and was probably more known in certain parts of the country, but he was a major, major player figure. But there are people like Grant Wood and other artists who were of that time period and depicted a certain kind of Americana, but also kind of some of the dark side of what was happening in the world as well. And Benton did that too. I mean, Benton's had, you know, major documentaries by people like Ken Burns and but he did all this stuff. He was kind of one of the main teachers of Jackson Pollock, and his influence is felt all over the place. But I do think that he's not known as much, you know, he's not spoken of as much now in 2019 as he certainly was at one point. What do you consider his kind of legacy to be? Obviously, he means a lot to you personally, and you've done a whole book of his. But, you know, do you think his work endures and carries on, and the themes that he dealt with are still relevant today?
No doubt about it. And definitely my first entree was being from Kansas City and owning this lithograph. But one of the things that I discovered writing the stories as I'm looking at these people, and even though they're from a time and place very different from my own, they end up facing the same challenges. And this is one of the things I think that Benton was most known for and deserves to be continually known for, is that he was an early painter. He was one of the early painters to depict ordinary Americans. So in his paintings, we see steel workers and dance hall girls and bank tellers and farm workers and just the gamut of the people who make up this country. Black, white, musicians, preachers, tent meetings. You know, even though he's from Missouri, and he also spent a great deal of time on Martha's Vineyard, and he also lived in Paris and New York at different points in his life, but he really is, as you mentioned, a regionalist painter. He's one of the, possibly the best. I don't know if he's the best known, but I think he deserves continuing attention because of the America he portrayed and showing it to be such an incredible smorgasbord of humanity. And in the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York, they have one room dedicated to his mural, America Today, which is just, I highly recommend that everyone go see this. It's an amazingly vibrant mural, and it covers the four walls. It was originally commissioned by the New School for Social Research and then purchased by an insurance company and then now is at the Metropolitan Museum of Art. If you go in there, and you mentioned Jackson Pollock, who, as you said, was a student of Benton's, he also, Benton also used Jackson Pollock as the model for a steel worker in America Today. And if you go in there, I mean, look at America Today, how we in 2019 and how divided we are, and yet how richly, vibrantly diverse we are. And Benton is an artist who portrayed that incredible diversity of humanity, of Americans.
I've been a big fan of his work for a long, long time, and I used to think what he did for the time he was in was he captured the idea of America in some ways more than the realities. And I always thought, you know, if you brought someone over to America, blindfolded them, put earplugs in their ear, and they had no sense of anything visually, orally, anything like that, and you wanted to give them a sense of what that is, I always said you sit them down in front of a major piece by Benton, you make them read something by Mark Twain, and you make them listen to something by Aaron Copland, and that would give them the idea of America.
Quite a trio, right?
Because Mark Twain and Benton, obviously both being from the same, you know, general area, I feel like they're always very connected in my mind, you know, the kind of ideas and some of the things they tried to relay. And there's a timelessness to those things that that goes on.
That's right.
What was the most difficult part of taking this on? Because obviously you had this one piece you started with and you had kind of like your whole life to think about that story. So you write that piece and then you decide to dive into these other pieces. When you have this general conceit in mind, like, okay, I'm going to take on this project and write stories based on these pieces, on these lithographs, do you ever hit a wall and say, okay, maybe I've bitten off a little bit more than I can chew? Maybe not every piece, you know, has a story to tell. Or do you think that you could have done this for an ongoing project? Because once you figured out kind of how to look closely and tell a story that happens within the narrative of a picture, you could kind of do that forever?
Oh, yes. I think you could do it forever. The way I selected the stories that are in my collection was I looked at the Bath book and would flip through and find a picture, one of the lithographs that resonated with me, that I saw something happening or some emotional tenor to it, and I would pick that, and then I would see where and when it had been originally created, so I would go online and start doing research. Like, one of the stories in the collection is about the Great Flood of 1937,
right,
which I hadn't known about, and so, you know, I would go research that. And so the research would be prompted by what I saw in the picture. And this, I don't know if you know the term ekphrastic. That's exactly what this book is an example of. Ekphrastic fiction or poetry is writing that's based on visual art. And one example of that is Ode on a Grecian Urn by Keats.
Okay.
Another more recent example is The Girl with a Pearl Earring, which was originally a novel and then made into a movie based on a painting by Vermeer. And there are many examples. Susan Vreeland was a novelist who wrote ekphrastic fiction. There are many examples of ekphrastic fiction and poetry. Auden.
Okay. And so you decided to take that to the nth degree and do a whole book taking on that exercise.
Yes. Yes, exactly.
Even though the lithographs cover a big time, I think the time period that people most associate with Benton is kind of that Depression era, Dust Bowl period, kind of that WPA aesthetic.
Yep.
We kind of have gotten to a place where a lot of the people who lived through that are gone now, and we're losing them day to day. And so there's going to be a time coming up soon where we won't have a lot of people who have a visual, you know, memory of living through that time period. And I think in some ways we romanticize it in a certain way, even though it was such a difficult time. Why do you think people kind of romanticize the Dust Bowl or that time period? Do you think it was because of the way people came together, the more community aspect of how people united to try to take care of each other? And, you know, there is something about that that carries on to this day.
Well, it could be. I mean, I think a lot of it isn't romanticized. If you think of Grapes of Wrath, or certainly there are other artistic or verbal representations that aren't romantic.
Those were of the time period. I'm thinking more things like things than now. You know.
Okay, looking now. I think probably one of the reasons we would romanticize it is because families were intact. People live closer together. Multi-generations were together. So, I mean, people in a town, people knew each other. I mean, in that sense, it's something that our culture today, where everybody's so far flung.
Yeah, everything's very fragmented. People were literally living in one room together at one time. Yeah.
Yes, yes. Or multiple generations in one house.
Yeah.
Or certainly at least on a farm or in one town.
Was your family impacted in any way measurably by that time period, or you weren't necessarily living, you know, or your family maybe, I don't know where they're from, but, you know.
Yeah, both my parents were from Kansas City, and they were young during the Depression. They were very young. They were children. My mother's family was on a farm in Missouri. One little thing I remember is my aunt talking about, my great aunt talking about the soup that she made. She called it ripple soup, and it was just like broth and like bread made into little balls, something about that was a Depression era recipe.
Right.
Other than that,
necessity is the mother of invention in terms of eating back then.
Yes.
I would imagine there are still living heirs from Benton, his estate, people who control, you know, all of his assets and his legacy. Did you have to do anything to kind of run this project by his heirs or anyone to show them what you were doing with his work?
I did not contact any member of his family. I did contact the representatives for his artwork. It's Artist Rights Society, Benton Testamentary Trust. And I corresponded with them over the course of writing these stories, and they put me in touch with the various art museums that hold the original lithographs. So I had to contact each of the museums, too, to get permission to reprint them in the book.
Today's episode of Museum Confidential is brought to you by the incredible and not entirely edible art supply known as egg tempera. That's right, folks. Painting with eggs is what we are referring to. Well, egg yolks, to be more specific, and pigment, and some water. The egg holds it all together. This stuff was a hot commodity during the Renaissance, but fell out of favor with the rise of those fancy schmancy oil paints. But guess what? Egg tempera never really went away. In fact, it's ready for a comeback. And that is no yolk.
Growing up in Kansas City, Kansas City has an amazing museum there at with the Nelson Atkins Museum. And did museums play a big role in your life growing up? Did you visit the museum very often? Did you, you know, your parents take you there? Yeah.
Yes, I love going to the Nelson Art Gallery.
And, you know, you talked about going to the Met. Do you see yourself, I'm guessing you still like to visit museums, you go to museums even when you're not working on a Thomas Hart Benton project, but could you see yourself doing this again with anything else, you know, with another artist, you know, perhaps, or with something
Definitely,
else? Has this
yes.
kind of sparked something in you that might continue at some point?
Yes. I'm not using visual art in the novel that I'm currently working on, but although there's a poster by Alphonse Mucha that plays a small role in the novel, but what I'm using visual art for now, I teach classes both in my home and elsewhere in New Jersey, and I give writing workshops different places, and I often give my students a postcard with an image of a painting and urge them to use that as a prompt. I think it's a fabulous writing tool.
You know, one of my favorite things about reading the book was that we're always encouraging people at the museum to look closer and to spend more time. You know, the average amount of time people spend in a gallery is quite short, and a lot of people do kind of what we call the circuit, and they just basically make a pass through, and they don't spend a lot of time standing and really looking at the piece. And a project like yours, you know, lends itself to saying, hey, you play a part, you know, the viewer plays a part, and that the artist has presented you with a moment in time in many cases, and you can do this activity of kind of filling in the narrative gaps. You know, what happened before this moment? Where is it going after?
Yeah.
What's happening in that background and that little house, or who's looking through that window? The viewer of a piece of art plays such a huge role. Do you think about art and you look at it differently now that you've kind of started doing this?
Again, I think it would be great if in your museum you could offer classes for adults or kids. You know, it's a workshop. It's a great way to get people involved.
To use the works of art as a jumping off point to saying storytelling matters and narrative matters.
Exactly. In the workshops that I lead, I have a pack of photos or postcards of famous works of art, and I'll pass those around and people pick out the ones that they're interested in and write something. And what's so great is because two different people could look at the same painting and come up with completely different stories, because the viewer is bringing their own psyche and experiences, etc., into their viewing of the work of art.
Thank you. Folk icon Pete Seeger would have turned 100 this year. Thomas Hart Benton was friends with Pete's father, noted musicologist Charles Seeger. More than just a depictor of musicians and musical scenes, Benton also played, busting out a mean harmonica every now and then and starting a band called the Harmonica Rascals. In 1942, Benton released an album for Decca Records called Saturday Night at Tom Benton's. The first time Pete Seeger heard the song John Henry, it was Thomas Hart Benton who played it for him. The song would become a staple at Seeger's shows.
Oh, where'd you get your liquor? Oh, where'd you get your dram? I got it from a pretty gal passing through this land.
Kill along home, Cindy, Cindy, kill along home, Cindy, Cindy, kill along home, Cindy, Cindy, I'll marry you someday.
That's our show for this week. Museum Confidential is produced and edited by Scott Gregory at the studios of Public Radio Tulsa. To learn more about what's going on at the museum and at the station, visit philbrook.org or publicradiotulsa.org, or both. We suggest both. Until next time, look closer.